Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. What's the mosquito population like in your neck of the woods? We'll be talking about mosquitoes and other insects as well today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014, and he stops by to talk about insects every couple of months. So it's great to have him back. You may have questions about mosquitoes or ants or other things that might be bugging you, and I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Phil Pelletieri, good to see you again.
Nice to be here.
Well, we had a very cold winter, but then we had a wet spring. How has that affected the mosquito? Wet is not a good thing when it comes to mosquitoes, I imagine.
Cold really does not seem to have much of an effect just because they're usually in a life stage that can either tolerate it or they're more protected. Like many of them overwinter its eggs down in the soil. And so, you know, they don't see the temperatures. It is to me always about moisture in sustained moisture where you get flooding and ponding and the like. And so it's interesting from the southern part of Wisconsin, what I've observed versus last year, which was also quite wet, is things haven't gotten near as crazy. I mean, it was sinful how high the populations were by the end of May and the first week of June last year. And although we're seeing mosquitoes now, and you can get into some hot spots, it isn't as widespread. And so you always ponder what the significance of that. There have been times we have witnessed where it has been so wet that we keep flushing out the breeding sites. And because of that, sure, you don't get the kind of hatch. But, you know, once you get in the summer and you get ponding water, the floodwater mosquitoes can pull a generation off in about 2 weeks, you know. And so it's always watching the rainfall patterns and where it's coming from. And, you know, to assess an individual situation, you have to know which of the 54 kinds of mosquitoes we get, because some of them only come from 200 yards away in a swamp. Other ones are floodwater mosquitoes that could come from 15 miles away, which makes life far more difficult to deal with when you talk about control.
And they bite us? Are they hungry? Is that why? Or?
It's females looking for protein to produce eggs. The males do not bite. Females, interesting enough, are capable of going through as many as three or four cycles of laying eggs, refeeding, and the like. And this is significant for disease reasons, because a lot of mosquitoes start their life as adults without carrying disease. But if they feed on something that has malaria or whatnot, then they acquire the disease, and then they can spread it the next time they bite.
You know, I play golf or whatever when I'm out with my daughter, and she loves to golf with me because the mosquitoes come after me and leave her alone.
Yeah, so, you know, there's been a lot of research on the dynamics, and we know carbon dioxide is the big one, and lactic acid that you generate when you're active, and acetone. So what they've done is they put people in these gas chambers and collected all the gas and figure out what these things are. So they can kind of come up with a concoction that's equal to the average person. But the researchers will tell you that there are individuals, for whatever reason, that they really can't put their finger on, are more attractive than others. The mosquitoes are responding to a variety of cues. And as I said, that is a phenomenon that we hear about quite a bit.
I always thought it was because I throw off more body heat or something.
Well, that would be part of it. And the carbon dioxide and lactic acid, as I said, are the big ones. And the more active you are and whatnot, the more you go. But we even talk about the color of clothing, you know, the dark colors attract them more, light colors less. But they're all subtleties, you know. You can follow all the rules and you're still going to get bit by mosquitoes.
When it comes to your yard, I've got a yard party coming up with a bunch of cross-country runners from my daughter's high school. What about sort of keeping the population down for an event?
Yeah. So there are a number of companies now that will commercially come and spray your yard. And when people ask me what I think of it for something like this, where we're going to a wedding or a, you know, a neighborhood picnic or whatnot, it's very appropriate to spray the shrubbery 3 or 4 days before. And there's a number of sprays that can be used so that any mosquitoes that come into the area will be knocked down. But where I'm not as comfortable with it is if you do this repeatedly, you are upsetting the balance. And you find out you will get problems like spider mites and scale insects on some of your plants and the like, just because things are so out of whack. So, as I said, I kind of use it as an ace in the hole for the right situations. And they're basically using a residual insecticide that, as I said, if anything lands on the shrub or bush that was treated, will be killed for week to 10 days. And And it does help significantly, as does a pretty nice breeze that night, which have no control over.
I have a box fan on my front porch, and we like to sit out on the front porch at night. I just turn that fan on, and much less problem.
Yeah, I used to tease about renting a hurricane machine, but that they use in the movies. But really, you get above 10 miles an hour, mosquitoes are not strong flyers, and they really can't put up with that.
And, as you look at their role in our ecosystem, let's say, the few bats that we have left, do they eat them?
Yeah, and birds do, but I've always argued there are so many other little gnatty-like things that they can feed on. I think a whole lot of things would do just fine without mosquitoes. And from a human perspective, it was really difficult to come up with nice things to say. As I said, because they're responsible for very significant human diseases and livestock diseases. And one of the concerns we're having as climate becomes an issue is that, a number of reports have shown that we are probably going to be more prone to some of these diseases like dengue fever and whatnot as the climate warms.
And we had one caller who couldn't stay on, wondered if garlic, eating a lot of garlic is a good repellent for mosquitoes.
You can prove that it works a little. But again, as far as a strong repellent, no, as is, I know my colleague, Dr. Susan Paskowitz, who's the chair of our Department of Entomology, she often has students, try these little experiments, and they found that bananas make you more attractive. But the bottom line is what people are looking for is a night or day difference, and most of these food additives and B vitamins and whatnot are not going to be night and day difference for you.
You get bitten 18 times instead of 20.
Right, and still be disappointed then.
Okay, Judy and Madison, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I have a question about carpenter ants.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We had a swarm of them about 3 weeks ago in the window above the kitchen sink. Mm-hmm. Like birds of winged ants. And we had carpenter ants maybe 25 years ago, too. And at that time, they drilled holes in the wall and dropped poison in.
Yep.
Is that still the treatment?
Well, where it's changed is they used to drill between every wall stud and treat every nick and cranny of the house, which I always used to say is rabbit hunting with a tank, because it's really... if you know where the spot is, and so given that you know there's a problem in the window, what I would suggest is you can go to the hardware store and whatever ant spray you buy. But what probably would be useful is if you've ever used a WD-40 can, there's a little red straw that you put on it that allows you to pin stream. So if you can find a spray that will allow you to go into that any corner or crack in the windowsill and treat. Now, it's likely the nest is right there. I mean, this is the kind of evidence we look for centering a nest. And so it's a spot treatment. My only concern is that sometimes the nest is 2 feet away from where you spray, and then it will not be successful. But a classic carpenter ant place to attack is where wood is softened. So I wonder if the windowsill or whatnot has had some water problems historically, and the ants are taking advantage of that. So as I said, that's the exact thing that I tell people to look for is – what we always tell people, the way to control an ant is find the nest. They've given you strong evidence. There's no question they're nesting in the house. They're nesting close to where that window is. So you just spot treat that one little spot. If there's no potential access, then you might have to drill one small hole. But I bet you that there's a crack or a seam somewhere that you can get that pin stream in, and let's see what happens.
Yeah. And probably the best approach, too, is then fix the window.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth assessing. And, people often get in this confusion if they see that it's a rotten windowsill. They said the damn ants ruined the windowsill, and it's really the water that ruined the windowsill, and the ants moved into that environment. So we've gotten far less aggressive at controlling carpenter ants, and pest control companies have a couple other tools if you do not know where the nest is. But to me, you're 90% of the way there knowing where they're coming from, as far as I'm concerned.
There you go, Judy. Thank you so much for calling. Britt in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Britt.
Hi. A couple weeks ago, I was having a bonfire in my backyard and remembered that I had an old pile of wood, not like a pile of wood you'd burn in your house, but just sticks and things. And when I went to grab one of the logs, underneath it was these little glowing pinpricks, like a big pinhead. glowing green, like a glow stick had been bust in there. So I've never seen that, and I was very taken aback and wondering what that might have been.
My first thought, that the critters that we see here that glow are glowworms, which are more, you know, worm-like larvae, and they're related to fireflies. And they're interesting because the larvae, when they're happy, glow. But if you bother them, it takes about 2 minutes for them to lose their color. It's a metabolic thing. But there are also fluorescent fungi and
That's
things.
What
and
I was thinking.
I'm more inclined, because it's so small, that wondering again if it was one of those phenomena of something that was fluorescent or generating light. But, you know, as wood is starting to decay, that would be a more likely source.
I would agree on that. So you probably saw some fungi there, Britt. Thank you very much for calling. On to Ken in Butternut, Wisconsin. Hi, Ken.
Hello, Larry. Hi, and Phil. I have a comment to pass along regarding a lack of certain insects, primarily moths. I'm not seeing anywhere near the number of moths at night that I have past years. I mean, we've had Cecropia moths. We've had Luna moths. We have what I call the Nighthawk moths. And I'm seeing none of that this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if Phil has noticed any of that.
Well, you know, I go back to questions that we got on this show 10 years ago. Of people saying, you know, I don't hit as many bugs with my car anymore. And, you know, we were kind of scrambling, wondering if it has to do with land use changes and whatnot. But back about 4 months ago, there was a very interesting article written in the New York Times. And in fact, it showed up in a number of places about the incredible drop of insect populations worldwide. And where some of this came from was some studies in Germany, where they have been catching the biomass of insects for decades in some natural areas. And that's where they've noticed an 80% decline. And then as people are looking at other places, this is a common phenomena. And so, you know, somebody my age, I remember seeing how many moths that used to fly around the streetlights. And now it's not 10%, I think, of what I remember seeing. So there definitely is something going on. And honestly, it's a big concern if we're seeing this kind of drop. And people have pointed to a number of things. And land use changes is one of them, less diversity. But we're talking about pesticide issues. We're talking about climate issues. I mean, they all kind of roll into one. And this particular last year, things that overwintered as cocoons and whatnot that would be exposed probably at a pretty tough time, much like, you know, I lost some plants in my yard because of the 30 below that we experienced. You know, so there is some of that. But there's so many thousands of species. You should see more. Interesting enough, the one moth that the Department of Ag has said seems to be on an upswing is the true armyworm moth, but that's a migrant. You know, that thing comes in here, and they because it's sometimes agricultural problems, they keep tabs of it. So, but I agree with you. It just isn't the number of critters that are around when I was younger, and especially you start get out in rural areas. You know, in the city, there's so much light competition and other things going on. But if you go in areas that are somewhat undisturbed, you would expect a more constant number of some of these things, and we're not seeing it.
Valerie in Muscadet had emailed in that she has not seen a June bug yet this year in the Muscadet area, and was wondering about that. She remembers them hitting the screen door in May sometimes.
You know, and this one gets a little complicated because we've got a couple dozen species of June beetles in the state, and some of them have two-year life cycles and some of them have three-year life cycles, and we have peak years, you know, they kind of ebb and flow. That all comes in. But I've seen the same thing. I mean, because, to be honest, when I was younger, I liked to collect the various species of June beetles, and I just don't see them either. And, you know, there's plenty of lawn grass and environments that they should be breeding in. And so I think their numbers have generally declined also. Although, as I said, I haven't seen an exact scientific documentation, but that's definitely been my observation.
Well, let's take some more calls. By the way, you can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today here in Wisconsin with Phil Pelletieri.
entomologist extraordinaire. Great to have him back. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And Raleigh in Oak Creek up next. Hi, Raleigh.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. Long time haven't spoken to you. My question today is about the life cycle of the boss fly. And I've read some conflicting articles. It's not a pleasant lifestyle, to say the least. But I don't know the extent of how concerned should we be. Did I read correctly? It hitches a ride on mosquitoes,
okay.
And then
yeah.
The mosquito bites, and then the animal licks it into their intestine, or I don't know. It seems
real. Okay, so where it gets a little confusing, there's a whole family of botflies, and the one that you're referring to is the human botfly, which is not found in the United States. You can get it in Central America and South America, and they have this amazing thing of laying their eggs on mosquitoes, and then when a mosquito bites you, the egg hatches and the larvae migrates in, and what they create is a tumor-like growth on your skin, and there's a little hole where the critter is breathing through. So it's an incredible life cycle. In Wisconsin, we have botflies on squirrels and chipmunks and deer, and they all have somewhat different life cycles, and it's pretty typical of botflies to be host-specific, so they only attack a very narrow range of things, and we get some crazy things sometimes. I've seen samples of chipmunk botflies that get on cats, which doesn't work quite the same way. I mean, they normally don't attack cats, but you get some odd things. So, yeah, the true human botfly is, to me, the whole story is it's like a science fiction movie. But the idea that we do have botflies here, and on occasion, as I said, if you find a squirrel or you find a chipmunk, you can, or even a rabbit, there's one on rabbits, you get this tumor-like growth. And what happens is these things come popping out and go in the ground and transform in the adult fly, which is a very bumblebee-looking critter. And there's also versions of this on horses and on cows. And again, depending on it, the life cycle in the case of cows, they migrate throughout the body and end up on the back of the cows and create these warbles is one of the names that they're referred to.
So there you go, Raleigh. Thank you so much for calling. Ken in Algoma, we go to you next. Hi, Ken.
Yes, Phil, a couple of years ago I called you about some hard maple trees that I had that had all these quarter-inch holes in them, and you said that it was a horntail wasp. I have one tree left, and it has a bunch of holes in it. Last summer, there were about half a dozen of these wasps outside that I killed. But now this year, there are no leaves on the tree. I'm assuming the tree is dead. Mm-hmm. The larvae that are in there, will they feed on that dead wood, or does it have to be a live tree?
No. In fact, that's what they're a firewood insect, as far as I'm concerned. They're attacking wood that is going to be suitable for firewood very shortly. And so, you know, in maples in particular, and horntails like to get in maples, but there's something else that's taking your trees out, you know, and this is just a sign of the decline. Because you do not see horntails breeding in healthy trees is probably the best way to put
it. So maple decline or something like that.
Yeah, girdling root or verticillium, or, you know, there's so many of these subtle diseases that can get after them, but it's never a good sign to see horntails attacking. You know, and sometimes you see trees compartmentalized where, you know, they're hollow in the middle and the critters are fine, but as long as that cambial tissue on the outside of the bark is still living, the tree still grows. And so it isn't necessarily a sign that the tree is going to die, but it's definitely a sign that there is bad or dead and dying wood in it. And then if you cut it for firewood and bring it in the house, often in January or February, you get the adult horntails emerging, which they look scary, but they're really pretty harmless.
There you go, Ken. Thank you very much for calling. Thomas in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, great to hear you again, Phil. I've got a question, and then I'd like to make a comment after that. The question is, I butchered a few domestic rabbits a few days ago, and I like to eat the livers and the hearts and the kidneys. However, the liver, I could see, had some white liver flukes in there. I will believe that's what they were. Can I still eat the liver? Yet?
Ew, boy.
Do those get destroyed by cooking?
You know, they should, although, you know, interesting enough, I mean, flukes are a parasite and are not normally under an entomologist, I honestly think you should talk to a vet, because they would have a little bit better idea of the liver flukes of rabbits and where the problem is. You know, in other parts of the world, there are flukes that attack humans, including a liver fluke that can be very serious in Asia and whatnot. And so I, as I said, you would think normal cooking would generate temperatures. You know, flukes themselves are not necessarily I don't know what stage could be resistant to heat, so that would get them. But as I said, I'd be quite uncomfortable, and I think it'd be worth chatting with a vet about it, and just to see if they can give you some more background. Or again, it would probably be worthwhile to do a rabbit fluke search on the internet and get a little bit more background, because I said I'm not familiar with that particular species.
Yeah. So there you go, Thomas. You had something else you were.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment that if you just go walk around any neighborhood, and residential and commercial, and look at all the lawns that are being treated to kill just a couple of grubs that make a few brown spots, and they treat the whole turf for a couple of brown spots, and you know, that's what's killing off all of our insects, all the constant applications of fertilizer everywhere for just a few cosmetic reasons that are totally unjustified. We need to do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my take when people would ask me, you know, it's one thing fighting weeds, that's kind of a personal decision, I guess, but the probability of having a significant insect problem in a lawn in Wisconsin is, to me, about 1 in 300. And if that shows up, you address it directly. And to me, using preventative, I mean, this kind of goes back to when I first started as an entomologist. We used to put chlordane on every lawn in the state to kill grubs. And it was cheap. It was kind of an added thing you'd expect to have. And you just couldn't justify it. So we used a whole lot of chlordane. It showed up in a bunch of places it shouldn't, and that chemical had to be taken off the market. And to me, it was an overuse issue. And so, as I said, in a different climate like Texas or Florida, where there's far more pressure from insects, you can justify these preventative treatments. But I just don't think you can make the argument in Wisconsin that we have the kind of insect problems that need treatment with insecticides very often.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Thomas. Renee in Wazika, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Okay, this is more in the way of a report from a rural area. Overwintering, Asian beetles have been a constant here. And about a month ago, my daughter was here with my grandchildren, and they were sick on the ceiling, so much so that it was scary, thicker than I've seen them before. There was a little bit of agricultural spraying going on, and I noticed that within about 2 days, and I'm wondering if there's a connection in the land use department, in about 2 days, there isn't an Asian beetle to be seen yet.
Mm-hmm.
From they just disappeared all at once. And I haven't seen one. No box elder bugs, no Asian beetles in the house at all.
Yeah, I would think, considering where we are sitting in the calendar, so all these critters that spend the winter in the house, and of course you get a warm day and they wake up, so you can see them in January, you can see them in March. But once we start getting into warmer, consistent weather in May and whatnot, they have to leave and go and breed somewhere else. There's no way they can reproduce in somebody's home. And so I would expect, you know, they become active. You saw them, but they found their way outdoors because they've got to go through their life cycles. And then again, unfortunately, in the fall, it's going to be the next invasion. So I can't see how, you know, even when they invade houses and get into attics and wall spaces, when people spray the house, it doesn't solve things once they're in the walls because it doesn't get to them. And so I can't see where an agricultural spray away from it would affect it, as I said, versus this time of the year, I expect them to look for a place to leave. And as I said, then you can kind of mark the calendar, September and October of this fall is when they're going to start coming back in looking for shelter.
There you go, Renee. Thank you so much for calling. And of course, getting, you know, tightening up the house is what gets you
Yeah, if you can solve the riddle in, you know, sometimes it's as innocent as just, you know, checking the roof fence and making sure the screens are small enough mesh that the critters can't get through. But if you have an older farmhouse and whatnot, there's just so many places they can, can come in. And, you know, when people reside and whatnot, they're often using house wraps and other things, which help reduce the numbers. But you got to be realistic. I mean, if you reduce the numbers by 90%, but you had tens of thousands of them in the house before, you're still probably going to be disappointed at the ones that find a way of sneaking in.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks again, Renee. Tammy and Butternut, your turn. Hi, Tammy.
Yes. I got a question about earwigs.
Okay.
Okay, I live out in a farm, and I've got earwigs constantly. Now, my cobweb spiders, they do eat some of them, but I'm wondering how to get rid of them. And I mean, we get lots of them all the time. There's sunny side, and then I've got a shady side, and I find them everywhere. And I like to get my answer off the phone.
Sure. The one thing I would say, and this is teasing, but it's getting a mindset of why you have earwigs. If you made your whole backyard a sandbox, you would have no earwigs, because they do well where there's lots of plant material, when things are lush and the like. And I'm a little interested in Butternut, because, you know, historically the first earwigs moved into Madison back in the 80s, early 80s. And we watched them kind of slowly march through this state. And what I'd be interested in, how long you've had the problem, because in the early 80s, when they really were bad, you know, there's a whole bunch of things you couldn't grow, and they were always invading the house and freaking people out. I will tell you, I have not seen an earwig in my yard yet this summer. And that seems to be, over time, things get better. And in my guess, as far as north as you are, that you might be in the first 5 to 10 years of the earwig invasion. So anything you can do to keep things drier will help. It's often hard to justify treating them for what they do to your plants unless they disappear. And they love marigolds. Sometimes you find that they just eat the blossoms of plants. So things aren't performing real well, it'd be worth looking at it. If it comes to the point you want revenge, don't treat the plants. You treat the ground, because that's where the earwigs hide during the day. And then they come out at night and do their thing and then hide back in it. So any place where they're congregating is the best to treat. Coming indoors at this time of the year is a big mistake on their part. Nothing to eat. They die very shortly. Same type of thing for lady beetles. You start looking at caulking. But if you're going to seal things, where the weakness of most of our structures is where the foundation meets the siding. You know, there's often kind of a lip there, and earwigs will push up underneath there. Another classic place is where your water faucets come out, if that's not caulked in very well, because earwigs are often seeking moisture. And if there's not a tight fit there, they will squeeze through there, and then who knows where they'll show up in the house. So they said for problems in the house, it's kind of a physical sealing things. For problems in the garden, if you come to the point of treat, they come out of the ground about the 1st of June. As half-grown earwigs, the mothers raise them in the ground. You don't see them earlier than that. But again, what I've started to see over the last 10 to 15 years is that you get into August and they seem to be almost non-existent, even in bad years. And we have not. I mean, this should be a classic bad year for earwigs because it's so lush. It's so wet. That's what they do the best. They don't do well in droughts. And as I said, the interesting observation, at least that I've made, is that over time in areas, their numbers decline significantly.
I haven't seen one
in
Madison. So there you go, Tammy. Thank you so much for calling. Steele in Appleton, your turn now. Hi, Steele.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, I was curious. Communities now are using more blue LED lights. And LED lights can also be warm light. And I'm just looking at a website right now. It's called LED Lights in India. And down here in N, they say, in short, right color and right frequency can be effective, safe, clean, and may be a cheap way to kill insects. And in our condo, they're using the bluer light. And I don't see a spider making its nest that I used to watch for 30 years.
Well, it gets a little complicated in that there are certain frequencies of light that attract certain insects. And it tends to be a little bit more on some of the brighter spectrums. And so knowing that, you know, a lot of the cities now are using these sodium vapor lights and whatnot, which are far less attractive to insects on purpose. And they may have energy concerns and the like. So that does fit. And in restaurants, they use various lighting to attract flies into these zappers and the like. And so it works for some things. But for spiders, I don't know any spiders that react to the lights. In general, I think the wavelengths that a lot of LEDs generate are less attractive to insects. They're not made that purposely. You know, when we go out, we use special infrared bulbs that are more attractive to insects, and then we shine the light on a big white sheet so that, you know, we're getting as bright as it can, and it's like a magnet. But knowing that, as I said, I think a lot of manufacturers have gone away from those particularly attractive frequencies and gone to ones that are less attractive so that you can have the security lighting and whatnot and have less of an insect problem.
The talk about wavelengths and so forth in light reminded me of sound. And I have friends who, when they're outside, and this goes back to mosquitoes again now, they've got some little device that they put out and they turn it on and they claim that that keeps the mosquitoes away.
Yeah, well, I've seen two versions of that. We know that the male and female mosquitoes get together, and there's a certain frequency that of the wing beats that they're attracted to. In fact, it's very similar, I think, to the tuning fork for a musical instrument like a guitar for A. That attracts them. Now, I've seen other devices sold that are supposed to mimic the wing beats of dragonflies, which are the mortal enemy of mosquitoes, and they're supposed to. Mosquitoes don't think through this, you know, and so I don't see any science. It makes a good story, but I don't see any science. So I don't know. And then the other argument when you get into this, the complexity of life here is that there are 54 kinds of mosquitoes in our state. They don't all react the same to the same things. And so even if you could, luckily enough, find one that might repel it to one or two species of mosquitoes, I do not believe you're going to find one that is so repellent. In fact, in general, you know, the same thing is common. I know the wildlife people talk about this too, Dr. Craven, of, you know, when all these tests have been done, they found that the equivalent of a police car siren was repellent to cockroaches for about 24 hours. You know, they got riled up when they heard the sound, but they very quickly adjusted or acclimated to it. And so, as I said, it sounds too good to be true, and it is, that these sonic devices, as I said, keep the critters away.
Sue in Adams, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi. We live up on the castle on the Wisconsin River, just south of Castle Rock. And about a week and a half ago, just as it was going from dusk to dark, we were sitting on the deck and noticed these swarms of bugs above all of our trees. And they were swarming like starlings do when they go south in the come back in the spring. These big swarms are like the fish, when you see the fish in the oceans and stuff when they're swarming. Does he have any idea what kind of bugs those might have been, what was hatched about a week and a half ago? Oh,
boy, there's so many possibilities. When this type of thing, I would have to see, you know, if anybody could get just a critter, because lake flies do it, caddisflies do it. There's a lot of things associated with water. And what the phenomenon is with a swarm like this is they're usually clouds of males. And they often will pick a certain object that they'll always be. They'll show up at, you know, 6 o'clock at night, 3 feet above the garbage can for a week on end. You know, so they're using kind of a visual orientation. And then what the theory is the females come in and find a mate and go from there. So it is a mating swarm. But as I said, there's so many possibilities that I'd just be kind of wild guessing without seeing something more specific is what it looked like. You know, do they look moth-like? Do they look gnat-like? Were they big, small? And I mean, even with lake flies, there are dozens of species that could be.
Yeah, there you go. So if you've got a photo, you can send it in, Sue, and we could probably identify. Go to ideas at WPR.org. If you happen to have a photo, we might be able to help you out. Dan in Mercer, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Thanks for taking my call. Phil, I've been wanting to call you and ask you this question for 20 years, if you've been on the show that long, and I guess today's the day. Up here and other places in the state, I'm sure we have them, it's commonly called like a sand fly or a black fly or biting gnats. And I have two questions on it. One, what really is this thing? And two, how are they able to bite you and take a chunk of flesh out of you, and yet you don't feel the bite?
Sure.
You certainly feel it afterwards, the itching and the scabbing, and what's going on there?
Sure. There is something that's a biting fly called a sand fly, but this time of the year is classic black fly season. Now, black flies are called turkey gnats, they're called buffalo gnats, and they're called some other things we can't talk about. But they breed in moving water, rivers, creeks, and the like. When the adults come, they often swarm these little gnats, fruit fly-like almost, around your head. And when they bite, they are literally using an anesthetic. So you do not feel, and their bite is a multiple stab wound is the best way to describe it. They're just constantly peppering the tissue. And then you of course, bleed, and they feed on that blood and use that as a protein source, just like mosquitoes. But all that salivary component that they leave behind, it's quite typical to see a trickle of blood if you let them feed long enough. And again, they even have anticoagulants in their salivary components. But then typically, depending how you react to it, you can get this huge welt that might last for a couple, 3 weeks, and often becomes very itchy. And that's a classic black fly bite, around the head, the neck area. Interesting enough, a couple days ago, my wife, who likes to do a lot of gardening, woke up and her eye was swollen considerably below the eye.
Oh.
I know it's a black fly bite. Interesting. I couldn't quite find where the puncture marks are, but it's so classic. And although we have numerous species, the classic black fly season to me is the end of May, beginning of June. Then we sometimes get a second hatch from some different species. I know up in Eau Claire, you have problems from the Eau Claire River in that first couple weeks of August, which is the second wave. And so, people that are far distance away from rivers and creeks may not see them, but I've had cases where I was having moms reporting their kids getting chewed up in the sandbox in Oconomowoc, and we were suspicious that the black flies were coming off of the Wisconsin River. There are documented cases in Alaska where they migrate 200 miles, depending on how the wind flows, and bother cattle. So you can get these, and you even get this. Get a call from the golf course, everybody's getting chewed up today, and then tomorrow nobody sees them. Again, depends. You get these weird things. Now, if there's a river running through the golf course, it may be a seasonal problem for them, and that gets
yeah.
another whole headache. So,
and when they bite, they're injecting then something? Or
yes. That as I said, their mouth parts are little knives that are kind of multiple stab wounds, but they're excreting a lot of saliva that has the anticoagulant, the anesthetic, so you don't feel the bite, and more components. And that's eventually what your body gets so angry about and reacts to by giving you the welt.
So there you go, Dan. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects in your backyard and maybe in your community with our guest, Phil Pelletieri, an entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he comes back every couple months to talk with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in. We'll take some more calls. Walt in Green Bay up next. Hi, Walt.
Hi, Larry. Hey, Phil. I have a question I wanted to ask for years about mosquitoes. I read many years ago that one of the functions of mosquitoes is that they actually pollinate plants like a bee would. Is that correct?
There are some plants that mosquitoes can pollinate. There's not a whole lot of them. I remember that in particular there's a couple things up in the Antarctic and Alaska type of thing where mosquitoes are the only pollinators. So there are some examples of that, but generally, no. a whole lot of other critters are coming in to feed on pollen and nectar and whatnot that are far more important than mosquitoes. But it is technically correct to say they are capable of pollinating.
So they're good for the.
Well, as I said, this is an there's kind of conversations entomologists sit around and spend hours and hours talking about trying to come up with a benefit of mosquitoes. And as I said, when I really get into it from a human perspective, I can't go there. I just see far too many problems. And as I said, there's enough other diversity in the insect world to keep the birds happy and the like. And so It's hard from a human perspective to come up with good thoughts for very long okay. on mosquitoes.
There you go, Walt. Thank you. Tom in Barron, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you for the informative show you have.
Thank you.
Last Friday, I was out in the evening, and the June bugs around our area in central part of Barron County, I was out there at night, and I could hear this constant buzzing, and my trees were just solid with June bugs. Every tree I looked in with a flashlight, they're just swarms of them. There's hundreds, and I don't know if we just got lucky in our area to have them or what the deal is, but we okay. have no shortage of them here.
Okay, Tom, so the bad news about this story, from my perspective, we hear about this at times where you will get June beetles flying in, so much so that they'll defoliate oak trees and the like. You know, so there's this, and it's about a two-week phenomena, and it doesn't really hurt the oak tree much. It will really leaf out and whatnot. And you never see this at this intensity year after year. You see this kind of ebb and flow. But the concern is that quite often the year after you see these huge flights, you potentially we're going to have lawn problems. So it's something just to keep a watch on. The question is, are they laying eggs in your lawn or are they going somewhere else to lay in them? And somewhere else, it's not going to be a problem. But there is this relationship of the years that we have intense flights in defoliation of trees and whatnot in areas. That's often an area the following year that we will have these, as I had mentioned before, relatively rare to have significant lawn problems. But after that, they are capable. And what you will see typically is from midsummer or later next year, you often get skunks or raccoons coming in and tearing up the lawn, which is bad, if not worse than the darn grubs, because there's so many grubs there to feed on. And the argument is that the skunks aren't dumb enough to come into a lawn where there's no grubs type of thing. So if they're rooting around and doing that damage, there's high grub populations. So something just to keep in mind, it's not the end of the world. But as I said, when I hear a story like what you had witnessed, I get a little bit nervous about the turf damage that you potentially can see the following year.
There you go. Thank you so much, Tom, for calling. Dan in Door County, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi, guys. I have a question about tent moths. I have a tent. It looks like a tent moth nest or whatever in my hawthorn tree, and the limb that it's on doesn't look very healthy, and I'm wondering if tent moths can damage trees.
Sure. So the tent caterpillars we see in the spring are capable of eating every leaf off a tree. They're somewhat restricted as far as most of them feed on flowering fruit trees, so hawthorn would fit into that category. But the tree will leaf out, so it's all cosmetic. It really is not a worry, and there's only one generation a year. At least my bumping around in the southern part of the state, tent caterpillar numbers are way down, which is kind of what I expected because they spend the winter as eggs up on the twigs, so they were very exposed. So that's one insect that I do find when you get 30 below and whatnot. I do, even though they're native, have a tougher year because, as they said, they lay their eggs in a situation that make them more susceptible to that kind of cold weather.
So there you go, Dan. Thank you very much for calling. By the way, you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Send us your email, maybe a photo, to ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Aaron in Hartford, it's your turn. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about honeybees. So we have a compost by a very large evergreen, and I was putting the compost out, and hear humming, and I thought it was a car coming down the road. It was such a loud humming, and come to realize it's like a bank of four or five evergreens, maybe 25, 30 feet tall. The whole thing is infested with honeybees. They're on every branch, and then I went around to the other trees on the property, the other evergreens, and the same thing, a humming, and every branch is, you know, it's a loud humming that you can hear, but they're not aggressive in any way. And I guess my question is that common, or and is there anything about the tree that I have to worry about?
No, so, you know, depending on when the time of the year this call comes in, when it is in the fall, it usually isn't honeybees, it's yellow jackets, and sometimes it's because the trees have an insect problem that's secreting a sugary substance, and that's what they're attracted to. But I would guess at this time of the year, it's more likely that the honeydew or honeybees, they are honeybees because you don't have big wasp numbers at this time of the year, might just be working resins and taking it back, you know, for the construction within the colonies. And although, you know, I don't know exactly what why there's so many of them, but I that has to be what's going on. I mean, I can't think what else would be attracting them to the trees. And, yeah, I can't see anything that would be tree health related from this. I think they're just utilizing some of those resins, again, in comb construction.
There we go. Thank you, Aaron, for calling. Clint in Northern Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Clint.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. I have a couple questions. One is, have you heard about the lantern fly? It's like decimating oaks out east.
There is a spotted lantern fly that has been now established for 3 or 4 years in New Jersey and the like. It's kind of a messy insect more than anything else. I don't know if I've heard oaks being the preferred host, but it's kind of aphid-like in that you get a lot of honeydew and that kind of stuff. And the concern is because the eggs are laid on plants to get through the winter, that nursery stock will be the most likely way of it going. It's still somewhat isolated, but boy, you start to look at the map and it's growing fast enough that you kind of say, we're not going to stop it. But it doesn't seem to be, you know, we were so concerned about gypsy moth because we know gypsy moth and the way it feeds can stress oaks enough that they will eventually die. It doesn't seem to have that kind of impact, as I said, in comparison for at least what I'm aware of. And it has not gotten this far, although the projections, the southern Illinois may be a little bit more attractive. I from what I've seen, the climate in Wisconsin, they suspect we might be far enough north that it's not going to be a big issue.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil, I don't know, Polly sent us a picture of a spider and wondering what that spider is. Looks like a nice big one.
Yeah, it's definitely in the wolf spider group or fishing spider. I'm leaning towards fishing spider, the Dolomites, which are some of the biggest, scariest critters we get. I honestly, to tell the difference, would have to see its eye patterns to be 100% sure, but even though the name implies that fishing spiders are going to be close to water, they can wander big distances away, and they're a nighttime hunting spider. And so that's why they often show up in places. And if they fall in the window well, sometimes they can't get out, that kind of thing. But so as I said, I would think Dolomites fishing spider would be the most likely source. Most of the wolf spiders, not as much banding on the legs and usually more a lot of black and white striping and the like in them.
Yeah.
And as I said, so this is a common one. And in fact, it's interesting. I was at a minor league baseball game here, and I know the Fondlac team is called the Dock Spiders, and this is what they're named after. And my grandson was asking why, and I said, well, they're big and scary looking, so that, you know, might be why they thought it would be a good image for their baseball team. So
there you go. And thanks for calling again, Clint. Barb in Green Bay has something. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am an avid camper up in Grand Marais, Michigan, Lake Superior, and always plagued by stable flies. And I know not to wear blue clothing, but is there anything that repels them, any scent of any kind?
Not, you know, the problem with stable flies is they're a hit and run feeder. And so they come in so quick and do their thing. I just don't see any repellents that I've ever seen. I mean, some help a little bit, but to me, it's all cover up. So, you know, I've make sure I've got socks on when I go fishing. And, you know, the interesting phenomena with stable flies is, you know, they have been documented to migrate 200 or 300 miles from where they breed. But it's quite common for their populations to pile up along the Great Lakes. And I think a lot of that's temperature related, you know, and so they're always sitting there patrolling back and forth on the beaches and the like. And so it is a common phenomena that once you get into the summer, they show up and make life miserable. And you know, for people that haven't ran into them, they're kind of like deer flies in a sense. But to me, about twice as mean. But that's just my perspective.
Okay, Barb, thank you. Craig in Athens, your turn. Hi, Craig.
Good morning. I'm wondering about the monarch butterflies that I'm seeing around my farm, and there's no
No milkweed.
The milkweed yet. So I'm wondering, are they laying eggs or?
Well, if they can find.
They are where?
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of milkweed up. You know, this year my first monarch that I saw was about now getting close to 3 weeks, which is exciting because, you know, because of the way they migrate through, sometimes we don't get the right wind patterns to get them up here until July. But I think there's enough stuff, you know, our butterfly weed in our garden is up, you know, a good 8-9 inches. And so there are plants there. In fact, the monarch I saw in my backyard, I was trying to see if it was going to go over there and potentially lay some eggs for us. But I did not see it land on our butterfly weed.
Yeah, my milkweed is 2 feet high at least.
Yeah. And so this would bode well. I mean, there's so many things can affect their populations. But even though, you know, there's been a little bit of a resurgence, I know, in Mexico, which people are happy with. But the last couple summers have been good monarch years for us in Wisconsin.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, retired head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll be with us up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us. And then we'll be back with Phil, so you stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Entomology, where he headed the Insect Diagnostic Lab and retired from that in 2014. So it's great to have him here. Lots of open lines. We can get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails and photos, Julie emailed kind of a gruesome photo in a way. Her Prius was parked in the garage with a window down, and she didn't drive it for a couple of days. When she got in, she saw, and she put a photo in here, the opening of her CD player. It's a small hole in it, and when she took the vacuum to it, there were what looked like some maggots inside. And it's what do you think that is, Phil?
So, you know, without the picture, where I would go is, you know, if anybody thinks about the classic maggots you see with dead animals or you know, garbage, think that, you know, somehow there was some protein source, a dead animal, and like, but the picture doesn't look like that to me. The picture appears to be something of an inch or so in length. And if you look at it very closely, it almost looks like it's filled with little rice or other things. And so where this takes me is I wonder if there was a caterpillar that was crawling around and crawled into that area to spin its cocoon or pupate. But instead of emerging as a moth or butterfly, it has parasites in it. And what this looks like is there are some little parasitic wasps that will sting larvae, and they develop into multiple maggots within that body. And then they will emerge. And what's so crazy about this biologically is that the female can lay one egg, and it will develop into multiple offspring. We call that polyembryony. But the other interesting thing is this has been studied quite a bit in that the percentages of male and female from that one egg will differ depending on the quality of the host and the size of the host, which to me, again, is just mind-boggling of the capacity to take care of it. So as I said, it looks to me like a parasitized caterpillar, and these little gnat-like wasps that don't sting people, they're just parasites of insects, come out, and that... So that's where the picture has taken me, that it's one of those. And that's pretty neat. If you told me to go out and find one of those, I don't think I could do it. So that's a pretty neat picture.
It is indeed. Steven is a wildlife educator and is outside all day. He doesn't like chemical mosquito repellents, so he did some research to see what ancient cultures did. And he came across lavender oil. He applies it to exposed skin and reports that he can go out into the woods where he's normally swarmed and watch the mosquitoes come in close and immediately fly away.
Yeah. So there's a lot of natural plant oils that have been looked at as repellents, and a lot of them work quite well. I mean, oil of eucalyptus is another one that is found in even commercially produced They differ in how long they can keep things away, and that's why you see. So you can go to something like Consumer Reports and get really a very big list of various products and how they perform. And I think the main thing about some of the natural plant oils, even catnip, there is some real interesting properties of catnip that work against mosquitoes. But generally, the natural products only last for an hour or two versus some of the other products, you know, the DEETs and whatnot. You can talk about products that can last for 12 or more hours. So they may have to be reapplied. But there's a number of ways we can keep mosquitoes away. And most of the techniques biologically confuse the mosquitoes. They get to a certain point and they do not recognize you as a food source. And it's because these products are tying up some of the receptors on the mosquito's antennae. And as I said, they get confused. And so it's really kind of an interesting phenomenon to watch. The repellency is usually short distance, 2 or 3 inches, but that's all it needs.
That's all you need. Jill just let me know that PJ Leash has a new article out for Wiscontext.org. And it's where and when the black flies are out in Wisconsin. And we put a link on our program notes for that article if you want to take a look and see. I've had some other emails from people saying, oh, my goodness, I got them all over. Swarms of them. And so yeah, they're around some places but not in others.
And it goes hot and cold. I mean, there are certain years that at the end of the year when you think about it and say, boy, this was a particularly bad black fly year, and then you might go 3 or 4 years and not see it. I said there are areas that are prone to it. I used to know going up in the Wolf River the last week of May was asking for it type of thing. Interesting, there's, you know, again, a number of different species and a lot of other wildlife activity. A good friend of mine does a lot of bluebird work. And when the black flies come off the Wisconsin River, he gets almost a total loss in his bluebird hatches. And it's night and day. You know, the birds that get mature before that do fine. But the ones that hatch from eggs when the black flies are out, it really is a, you know, we have the same problem with the different species and the cranes up in central Wisconsin they're trying to rear. And by general, most of black flies are bird feeders and not human feeders. But there are a handful of species that will pick both on people and birds.
Carol in Madison will turn to you next. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I found in my backyard, I have a lot of wild violets growing, some leaves that have been rolled up, and there's like a caterpillar inside that's eating the leaves. I want to know if it's like a moth or a pest.
It could even be a butterfly, depending, you know, without seeing the caterpillar, and it gets difficult. Even describing it, I don't know if I could get enough, but I do know a couple butterfly species that will feed on violets. But more likely a moth. There's just far more moth species involved. And I don't know of anything that normally feeds on violet I would identify as a pest. So, you know, there are moths that are technically pests, you know, like armyworms or whatnot, some of the cutworms. But as I said, I don't think so. So it might be fun just to see what finally emerges out of this. You know, you know, life cycle usually goes in a couple weeks, maybe a smidgen longer. And it's quite common for caterpillars to tie the leaves. We call them leaf rollers, among other things, because that's a protected environment that hopefully protect them against some of the parasites that we talked about earlier. So.
So you're good to go, Carol, and it might be fun to watch and see what happens with one.
Yeah,
so
it's easier to identify the adults in most cases than it is the caterpillars.
Lynn in Spring Green, your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live out in the woods in rural Spring Green in a rented cabin, and both I and the people I rent from have strong feelings about not using toxic poisons. However, I have a really bad infestation of Asian lady beetles. And so I used to have the box elder bugs too, but they don't seem to be so much this year. My question is really, I guess, two. Are you aware of any more natural non-toxic repellents? These guys will bite me when I'm sleeping, mm-hmm. even, and be attracted to the light next to my bed because I like to read before I go to sleep. And then secondly, I've heard somewhere that the Asian lady beetles are suspect for making allergies worse, and I have allergies. So wondering about the allergies, wondering about maybe even something non-toxic that I can spray on my bedding or around because they're prolific. And then as I've been waiting, I realized I had a second question, but I'll listen to your answer about the first.
Okay. So the allergy thing has been proven if you touch Asian lady beetles, they bleed through their joints. It's a defensive mechanism. And those proteins they leave behind, some people become very allergic to. And so it just, again, like many things, it depends if you've developed the sensitivity or not. To me, once you let them get in the structure, you lost the war, no matter what. And so I don't know, have any magic indoors other than I do know some people have used these light traps, the little infrared or UV bulbs and attract them and zap them. But, you know, again, to me, you've already opened the door and allowed the problem to get there. So I go back to this point that, you know, in a cabin, spending the time, and especially high, any place where you've got where the roof meets the overhang and the like, of making sure that everything is tight and caulked and sealed as much as possible. And in particular, you concentrate on the sunny sides of the cabin, the south and the west, because if you watch how Asian lady beetles invade, they react to contrast in colors. And so when the sun hits something and then it's shady, they come into that interface between the two, and then they crawl up through there. Now, what the commercial pest control companies will use are synthetic versions of pyrethrum. So that is not organic, but the parent compound, pyrethrum, is. It comes from chrysanthemums. The problem with the parent compound is it degrades in sunlight. So you spray it and 2 hours later it's gone. And so even though it's as much a repellent as it is anything else, it has those limitations that it wouldn't work. And as I said, to me, understanding its biology, it's all about having the line drawn by the 15th of September, because they come in between the 15th of September and the 15th of October normally, and solving the riddle of how they're squeezing into your wall voids, your attic space, any of those other things is the permanent solution versus, as I said, I don't know of any chemical, even the synthetic chemicals don't work 100%, and you got to spray large areas and the like on the outside, but don't let them get in. The other thing you can look at a little bit is, you know, your light fixture from the ceiling. Make sure that that is sealed in tight, because if the space that they're getting into is above you, they're weaseling down through those kind of cracks and crevices to get into your living space. So sometimes even some tightening and adjustments inside between where they're hiding and where you are might give you some relief.
And thanks very much, Lynn, for calling. Good luck with your lady beetles. Let's go to Gene in Appleton. Oh, wait a minute. Lynn did have a second question,
yes,
if I'm not mistaken.
Lynn, you still there?
Oh, we lost her. Okay. Sorry, Lynn. Gene in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Gene.
Yeah, I'm here. I have a question about the grubs that take out the turf. A great deal of my turf was taken out by the Japanese beetle grubs last year. And I now have some not too successful grass replacing it. It's coming in quite well, but there's still bare patches. And I had it treated by a lawn service with grub control.
Mm-hmm.
And since I feed birds and have a lot of birds in this semi-rural area, I'm wondering whether there's any danger to robins and things.
Sure.
That...
To be honest, although generally the products that are registered for grub control, if they were highly toxic to birds in the way that used that way, they would not get registered. But there is a difference. There's a number of different products that could be used, and without knowing the specific product, it's a little hard to give you a generalization other than to say that the way it's usually formulated in the products that are more commonly used now are far less toxic to birds than the grub control stuff that we used to use 30 years ago, which really, honestly, one of the reasons that they have been taken off the market, or at least taken off from that use, is because of their toxicity to birds, like diazinon and whatnot, were chemicals that if the birds landed on when they were wet and applied, it was not good. What happens with a lot of those products, though, is once they dry, they really are far less likely to be absorbed and far, far less of a problem. So usually the labels are quite specific. And as I said, the companies usually will provide you with information if there is any concerns at all. And in most of the cases, the big concern is that first 24 hours when the stuff's applied. And after that, there really isn't going to be much.
And there you go, Gene. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Still time for you to join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Bob in Lake Nabagamon, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, you mentioned permethrin. Seems to be the rage to spray permethrin like as a barrier, as a defense all around a property, a la mosquito squad, I guess, to prevent mosquitoes. And my two questions are, well, three questions. Does it repel mosquitoes?
No, it kills.
Does it kill ticks? And is it safe for humans?
Okay. Permethrin is used in a number of different formulations. If you ever get scabies, which is a mite infection of your skin, they give you permethrin creams. So it's put on person. If you ever get head lice, permethrin is one of the shampoos that they use for head lice, although the problem there is a lot of head lice are resistant to it, so it doesn't perform very well. So there are registrations for its use on people. Now, it also has a bunch of uses. Vegetable gardens, spraying plants, killing ants. We had talked about earlier in the show that permethrin and its related products, there's a whole bunch of synthetic pyrethroids, bifenthrin, cyfluthrin, many of them, if you look at the chemical name, it ends in that THRIN. And what these are synthetic versions of the natural pyrethrin. But what the chemists have done have made the products last longer, which is both good and bad. It's good that it lasts longer, but that also means it potentially has more environmental problems. So, as I'd mentioned for the mosquito thing, you know, if you're going to have a party and you have your shrubbery and lawn sprayed a couple days before, it will give you quite a bit of relief. But from where I sit, I'm not excited about this used every 2 weeks all summer long against mosquitoes, because then you're killing a whole bunch of non-target things and you're upsetting the balance. So it isn't as much a human toxicity issue, although, again, in particular, and this is why it's so important to read labels of pesticides when you're using them or having people apply them, and they will provide you that information. Cats are quite sensitive to permethrin. I mean, not that it's going to highly irritating and whatnot. How would you know that? You read the label. It says caution, you know.
Yeah.
And so, as I said, anytime people are considering that, that would be the first place I would go, is to get the information provided under, you know, environmental concerns and those type of things that are listed on the label. And what makes it tough when you talk about generic permethrin, again, it's commonly put on clothing as a tick repellent. There, as I said, it's not even, if you read the label, you don't apply it when the clothing's on you. You spray it when it's off, you let it dry and then put it on. So you're cutting down your exposure. And there it is highly effective at killing ticks that can spread diseases. And so the cost benefit there to me is far outweighs any problem. But when people ask me the question, is it safe? As I said, it is used as both a prescription and as an over-the-counter on human for treating various problems. But the other side of it is, if you don't need the stuff, you know, why expose anything to it?
Sure.
You know, so it's kind of a, you know, an individual situation, you know, assessing is it warranted or not. And hopefully that's helpful.
Thank you, Bob, for calling. Let's go to Appleton, talk to Mai next. Hi, Mai.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, last year I found a cluster of some sort of grayish, bigger than the fly bug, and it's on my zucchini plant. And yesterday when I came out, the zucchini plant just, you know, budding, and it already have one on it. So my question is, what do you call it, and how can I do?
So what I think you got are squash bugs. And what you're seeing now is the adult squash bug that's going to lay the eggs, that's going to give you all those other critters that will bother you 3 weeks down the road. And so this is a great time to shut the door. Now, unfortunately, the immature ones, the babies, are easier to kill. You can even kill them with soapy water. The adults are a little bit harder. You might have to get a more specific spray, and there's a number of sprays, both organic and not, that will kill it. Or if you get lucky enough, you only see a couple bugs, you can hand pick them. But this is one of those examples that it's good to be very observant of your plants. They will lay a cluster of eggs that you can see. They're kind of elongated, kind of dark brownish. So you see those, you can scrape those off and the like. But keep in mind, when your plants are coming out of the ground in June, that's when everything gets started. And that's, again, when you can probably make the most significant difference, rather than waiting until you get in the middle of July and the eggs have already hatched and the critters have been bothering your plants for a couple weeks.
Yeah. So keep your eyes peeled, Mai. Thank you so much for calling. We have Joe in West Bend email us. He occasionally sees a huge swarm of small red ants where the sidewalk and driveway meet. There are literally thousands of them. After a few hours, they completely disappear. They look a lot like coffee grounds.
Sure.
Any idea?
Well, you know, what he witnesses is a swarm. Our native ants swarm at very particular times. Carpenter ants swarm in the spring, and our field ants and our cornfield ants swarm in the fall and late afternoons. But there is a non-native European ant called a pavement ant that has moved in the state in the last 20 years and become one of the most prominent indoor invaders. And they swarm at all different times. And I bet he's got pavement ants. Now, the name's deceptive because, you know, pavement ant sounds like it's got to be by sidewalks. Well, they'll nest in your house, too, given the right opportunity. And what makes them particularly miserable is rather than having one queen in one nest, they have multiple queens in multiple nests. Yeah. So they are a bit more of a challenge to deal with. But what's interesting is sometimes you get swarms of pavement ants and you never see them indoors. And so is it important to control them? Probably not. You know, it's not a big deal. But knowing that that's where the nest is, at least one of the nests, what I would suggest if you're going to treat them, you can treat the surface and the ants will disappear in minutes, but you haven't solved the problem. For this kind of thing, the nest is in the ground, and whatever you use, it's important to get it down into the ground where they come from. And so a lot of times what a dilute mix that you can pour into a hole type of thing would work. Sometimes I've even gone to the point of using a metal rod or something to make a couple holes to get down into the ground deep enough and then treat that. And what we're trying to do is kill the queens that are down into the nest rather than the workers that you're seeing swarming on the top. But they said, I would guess if you're seeing it different times of the year and whatnot, but always the same place, that's classic pavement ants.
Dee wonders if she's seeing honeybees in her arborvitae, and she's also seeing some scale insects in there, and wonders if the honeybees are going after maybe the honeydew from.
Yes, they do. Just like the wasps do later in the season is, and that's what with the question before coming in about the person that had the evergreen with a lot of honeybees. If it had scale insects, you know, they secrete all this sugary water, and it's like nectar. It's a dilute form of nectar, but honeybees will go after sugar water, and that could be. Most of the time, scales naturally are controlled on arborvitae. I don't see that. This is one of those cases, though, we talked about repeated mosquito control can cause outbreaks of this kind of insect because they take off that natural parasites and the like. And so, as I said, it is one of the negative aspects of repeated mosquito applications, you know, multiple times in the summer.
Well, Phil, it's always a pleasure. Here we are out of time. Thank you so much. You'll be back on September 18th, if I'm not mistaken. So look forward to that. Thanks, Phil. Appreciate it very much. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, and retired head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll be back September 18th. We'll do it all over again. On the show tomorrow, we talk about leaky roofs and other ways the rain can get into your house with home improvement expert John Freiberger. That's at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.